dealing with the permanent fund, and I'd like to start by saying that not only are there a few in this committee, there are a few in other committees as well, and I'd just like to share with you a list that we pulled up from the computer today of all of the bills and resolutions dealing with permanent fund earnings that are so far in existence. And I understand there are a few more coming, but those will tell you what both House committees and Senate committees currently have on the table dealing with permanent fund dividends and permanent fund earnings. How I would like to proceed this afternoon is as follows, and if the committee would prefer a different way, please speak out. We have had several of these before us before. We have heard from the sponsors on some of them, on others they are new. I'd like to start by doing two things. First of all, I'd like to hear from whoever is here today to testify on any of these measures, regardless of which ones, and let's just get all the testimony before us. And then after that, I would like to work on HB 83 and 84, which are the two bills that are less public policy and a little more mechanical, and see if we can perhaps get those bills out of committee today. And then I'd like to go one by one through each of them and see what the committee's wishes are in terms of either passing them out, amending them, or asking for additional testimony from other entities on them. So let me start. If the committee does not have any objections to proceeding in that manner, I'd like to just ask for the testimony from those who are here on any of these measures. Okay, let's see. We have two representatives from Revenue, Tom Williams and Irvin Jones, who are prepared to answer questions. Would you like to make any brief statements about 83 and 84? By way of, no, not until we're ready to work on them. Okay. And Representative Ellis, you don't care to say anything at this point until we get back to HGR 1. Well, so there's no one who wants to testify. Okay, given that, then I would like to deal with HB 83 and 84, see if the committee might be able to pass those two out today, and then we'll go right down the list, HJR 1, HJR 10, 128, 133, 134. I guess it might be helpful to have the Department of Revenue people come to the table to help us work through 83 and 84. I'm not sure that all of the committee members were present when you were with us the last time, so I wonder if you could briefly go through both House Bill 83 and 84 in terms of the rationale and the impact.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Irvin Jones. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue, and with me is Mr. Tom Williams, Director of the Enforcement Division. Tom had a great deal to do with developing this legislation, and so he's here with me to answer any questions that you may have. First of all, there are two bills that are companion bills and need to be considered together. HB 83 deals with the computation of the permanent fund dividend. And basically what it does, if you would refer to behind the fiscal note, I believe you'll find a chart that looks like this, I hope. Tried to lay this out so that it would be understandable to ourselves as well as members of the committee. The way the dividends are currently calculated is that there is an amount appropriated by the legislature, and from that amount there is an allocation for two expenses. One is for the administration of the dividend program within the Department of Revenue, and the second is for the hold harmless aspects of the permanent fund dividend law, and that is administered by the Department of Health and Social Services. The net, after taking out those two expense amounts, is allocated towards dividends. The Department of Revenue does an estimation of the total number of qualified applicants and divides it into that net amount, and thereby arrives at a dividend value. Now, that estimate includes, among other things, an estimate of the number of children that are under the age of 18 who for whom no application was filed. Of course, it's impossible to know what that number is, but we have done our best over the last 5 years at estimating it. This, as a result of that estimate, as a result of that calculation, there is an amount of money that is held in reserve, so to speak, for those 18-year-olds, as we think of them, the children that become 18 and then file for their own dividend. This bill would change that and would set it up so that the two expenses that I mentioned, if appropriated in that manner by the legislature, would be subtracted from the total amount of the appropriation. And the balance would be used first, in that year would be used first to pay all of these 18-year-olds that were identified in that current year. So what we're talking about is going from a system where we have right now 5 years worth of dividend appropriations sitting in the accounts, and the 18-year-old comes in and files for 1982, we take the money out of the 82 pot. Files for 83, we take it out of the 83 pot. Instead of doing that and keeping these appropriations on the books and keeping these estimated amounts holding out there, possibly to never be used if the children forget or don't come in or our estimates were lousy to begin with, rather than do that, we're saying the children that come in and say, here I am, I'm applying for my dividend in this year, we'll take them right off the top of the current year appropriation and pay them, and whatever's left is shared with the current year applicants. There's no money held in reserve for those people. It's no longer necessary. That's the purpose of 83. 84 is a one-time thing that deals with all of those outstanding appropriations that I referred to. There is a total of, by our estimates at this time, approximately $25 million, $20 of it, that would go from the dividend appropriations and would be available for distribution in this current year as to the current year applicants. The other, what's the total number? $4.6 million is from the original 1982 appropriation from the general fund and would lapse to the general fund for whatever purposes the legislature might choose. That's kind of it in a nutshell. I should say that the second bill, 84, would solve one other problem, and that is something that was identified by the legislative auditor 2 years ago. In the beginning, when the legislature appropriated money for the 82 program, they made a statement that the appropriation was, other provisions of law notwithstanding, and that sort of language, that this appropriation was a continuing, non-lapsing appropriation. That was in recognition of this problem with these children that would come back as many as 18 years later and want their money. That was not done in subsequent appropriations. And so technically, those subsequent appropriations should have lapsed June 30th of that fiscal year. That was not done. Those were put on the books as continuing appropriations using basically the same philosophy as was used originally. But one of the things that this bill does, it cleans that up and changes those lapse dates. So you see some references there to changing lapse dates for 1983, 84, and 85 to be June 30th of this fiscal year. And that is considered both by us, the Department of Law, and the legislative auditor to be a technical cleanup type provision. Is there anything else, Bob?
One thing that I might point out in House Bill 83, there is a provision there which would take any balances that were not used to pay dividends, any lapsing balances from the dividend money, and would roll them forward into the next year's dividend. That's why the reference to the $20 million that would roll forward into the 87 dividend. The idea is that those monies were originally appropriated for to pay dividends. Since we make an estimate of the actual number of individuals that will be eligible, those are not 100% firm figures, that oftentimes it is some amount that is in the dividend fund designated for dividends in the current year, which is not spent. What it allows it to do is whatever that amount that lapses, it rolls it forward into the next year's dividend, ostensibly to pay to keep it for dividend money, and could be used then to pay the 18-year-old first-time filers. The 18-year-old first-time filers provision is currently a statutory provision. requires us to pay those individuals who, upon reaching age of majority, apply and can demonstrate that they did not apply any of the previous years.
Do any of the committee members have questions about either 83 or 84? And if you do, would you flip on your teleconference? We have one observer in Petersburg. Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So let me get this straight. The money that we're removing those appropriations from 82 on, and we're taking that money that's left over in those accounts, and we're moving that into the account that the dividends are paid from, and then we're, so that money's not lapsing into the general fund?
Madam Chair, the monies that we're talking about that are available for paying these children, I may have referred to them as lapsing amounts. Those amounts are already in the dividend fund itself, which is the dividend fund is the fund from which the dividends are paid. The question of whether they, ultimately that money is paid out in dividends or whether it's something that could be appropriated for other purposes, I think is a question for the legislature to decide. But the theory of saying that it's going to be paid out in dividends in the current year is that the money was originally appropriated for that purpose, and due to a bad estimate on our part, not as many children came forth as we expected. The most accurate thing to do probably would be to write supplemental checks to each one of the people who qualified for the dividend in each of those prior years and send them $5, $6, $8 or whatever. It's an impractical thing to do. Probably the next closest thing to do in terms of equity, in my opinion, would be to pay it to the qualifying applicants in the year in which it's recognized. Probably 90% of those people are the same people that qualified in 82, 83, and 84 and got shortchanged, so to speak, in those years. And that's the reasoning behind suggesting that that money is available for dividends in 87 if this were to pass this year.
This is pretty complicated, and I'm trying real hard, so forgive me, gentlemen. So we're not reducing the amount of money that's available for dividends. We're simply adjusting the accounting techniques that are involved here.
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. There's no reduction in the available for dividends.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Boucher, do you have a question?
No. I was whispering down here, and I got an answer. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are there any other committee questions? Well, it is my impression that these are non-controversial bills which do not impact either the value of the dividend fund, or who is getting dividends. And for that reason, I feel as though it is appropriate for this committee to pass these bills out at this time, unless you have other questions or other discussion. I would be happy to entertain a motion to do so.
I would move that. Excuse me.
I'll go ahead and move that these two bills get moved out of committee with individual recommendations.
Is there an objection?
There's no objection. I just had one more. Since we're in discussion, I just had one more question for our guest. Is the chair's assessment of these bills accurate? Is they're not going to change who gets the dividends and the total amount that's available for dividends?
Madam Chair, there'll be no negative impact, but if these bills pass, the estimated value of the increase to the dividend, all other things being equal, would be approximately $39 in the 1987 year.
So you're saying there'd be an increase of about $39 in the current year's dividend?
Yes.
No problem? No problem. Okay. Representative Falcon.
How much total dollars are we talking about then?
The total amount would be approximately $20.8 million.
My question would be, why can't these funds go back to the principal? Permanent fund principal.
Well, I wouldn't say that they can't go back to the principal. I think that the legislature would have the ability to make that appropriation.
I gather what the Department of Revenue has done is simply said, this money is in the dividend account now.
That's true.
And so you're not making a public policy judgment that it should go someplace else. You're sort of saying the status quo says it stays in the dividend account. It's just that instead of holding it out there for some indefinite period of time for somebody to come along and claim it, you're just going to roll it into the fund. And then in the future, if someone comes along who could have claimed a dividend, instead of taking it out of this fund, which you've been holding on to, you'll simply take it out of that year's available dividend fund. Is that accurate?
100% accurate.
Okay. So, in a sense, it is possible for that $20 million dividend money to be appropriated by the legislature for some other purpose, but it would actually require us to take it out of the dividend fund to put it in someplace else, which theoretically could be done. This bill simply leaves the status quo and says, we'll leave it in the dividend account.
Or it could be appropriated to the undistributed income account.
Oh God.
It could be. It could be. Okay, any other discussion? Representative Boucher?
How does it impact, you said there's going to be a $39 increase. Explain that, if I may, Madam Chair.
Please.
Excuse me.
That would be a one-time increase. It would be for 87 only. Because of the dollars that are currently being held for the 18-year-old first-time filers would be rolled forward into the 87 dividend. And thereafter, whatever lapse balances would roll forward, but it certainly would not be $20 million. So it basically, the $39 would, since the $20 million would be included in what we compute, how we compute the 87 dividend.
Okay, all right.
You divide that, we estimated by 532,000 applicants, if there were that many, that it would have a $39 impact increase one time.
Yes, just basically how many dollars would that mean flowing out of the dividend?
The increase would be the $20.8 million.
Okay.
The additional. On to 50% of the earnings that go out to the dividends normally.
Well, you'd be to make that $39 increase, would that mean the expenditure of the $20 million?
Right. $20.8 million translates to what we're estimating $39 increase in next year's revenue. One-time increase.
Additional discussion? There is a motion on the floor. If there's no additional discussion, are you ready for the question? Do you want to separate it out, 83? And 84 together, or does it matter?
No.
Doesn't matter? Okay. The motion is to move out with individual recommendations, House Bill 83 and 84. Is there any objection? Without objection, then, if Judy Crandall would pass around the two bills, we will have at least those two on their way. Okay. Let us then move down. Yes.
Oh, I've just asked that you let the record show that this committee out the $39 to go to each recipient in the state.
I'm not sure anyone else will ever figure it out quick. you can talk about it back home. Okay, HJR 1, then HJR 10. Oh, there is one other person
much.
Who has indicated an interest in testifying, and that's Carrie Romsberg, who would like to speak on HB 133. If there's no objection, I'd be happy to take Carrie Romsberg testimony. Do you also wish to testify on HJR 1 and HJR 1 and 2?
Madam Chair, on 133, although I was late, I would like to testify since I was on transponded, and I'd actually like to do so kind of in concert with.
I'd be happy to have you come first. As the prime sponsor, Representative Pierce, we'd like to have you come first.
My apologies, Madam Chair, I have a finance subcommittee.
You will be missed. But have fun anyway.
Okay.
If you leave me out,
okay. Representative Pierce, thank you.
Are we on teleconference?
We are. We have an observer in Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Representative Drew Pierce. I represent Turnagain and Sand Lake in Anchorage. I'm speaking to you today about a bill that I feel there is a great need for, House Bill 133. An act relating to eligibility for permanent fund dividends and providing for an effective date. The student loan program within the state of Alaska is based upon a revolving loan fund, with loan repayments being used to grant loans in subsequent years. As the program has matured, repayments have become an increasingly important portion of the student loan funding base. During the last few years, the default rate on student loans has been steadily increasing. At the end of the 85-86 school year, nearly one person in six was in default on their student loan for a total of 14.7%. The increase in loan defaults has the effect of lowering the base available for future loans. I introduced House Bill 133 because I believe that something must be done to stop the escalating default rate, and something must be done to ensure that loans will be repaid so that money will be available for future loans. House Bill 133 would act as a deterrent to default by changing the eligibility requirements for the dividend program. Individuals who have received educational loans under AS 14.43 and whose payments are delinquent by more than 30 days would not be eligible to receive a permanent fund dividend. The need for this type of legislation is evidenced by the fact that last year alone, over 2,000 individuals who were in default still maintained their right to receive a permanent fund dividend. I propose that the state put a stop to this by making delinquent individuals ineligible for the permanent fund dividend program. I believe this measure will effectively deter student loan recipients within the state from falling behind in their loan payments. Thank you for your consideration of House Bill 133. I know that Dr. Ramsberg of the Post-Secondary Commission can enlighten us further, and I'd like to make one further comment. Dr. Ramsberg is interested, I know, in having the Post-Secondary Commission be able to actually go in and do attachments of the dividends themselves. Last year, of the over 2,000 permanent fund dividends that were received by students who were in default, the commission was only able to garnish 800 of those. The reason for that, partly, and he can enlighten us further on this, but a major portion of the reason for that is that the court system is so backed up. Plus, by the time that we do garnish those, we have a lot of court costs. We have a firm that we're using, a law firm that takes a portion of those monies. I feel, and this was a policy call, that post-secondary commission as an entity should not be what I would consider to be kind of a quasi-judicial body if they were allowed to do attachments like the Child Enforcement Agency. And that, as I understand it, is the only non-court ordered attachment that can be done at this time of the dividends. I didn't feel comfortable with there not being due process through the court system before we could attach a permanent fund dividend from a delinquent student. So I decided to make the whole focus of the bill a deterrent, and that's why it is in this form as opposed to giving post-secondary the authority to actually go in and do direct attachments without benefit of the court system. That's something that the committee certainly might want to consider, but that was my personal feeling.
Thank you, Representative Pierce. Any questions, or should we go on to Kerry Ramsberg?
Thank you. I'm Kerry Ramsberg, Director of the Commission on Post-Secondary Education. And Representative Pierce very fairly presented the position that I would like to address, as well as the reasons for justification for this bill before you. We took a look at what we have right now, and by the way, the default rate she quoted, which was last June's, I would crawl about 4 miles to have right now on my hands and knees. Our default rate has continued to escalate. It got up around 18%. It's now come back down a little at 17.5%. It's absolutely a terrible default rate. We have to do something to try to get a handle on this loan program. I'd also like to point out that we haven't even seen the impact of the high debts, the very large debts yet. In 1981, the legislature increased the borrowing amount to $6,000 per year, and if you figure person borrowed in 81 and in 82 and in 83 and in 84 and they had a grace year in 85, they're just now into that paying cycle. So we haven't even seen the big debts yet. So I don't know that we've seen the last of the default rate climb. We're doing some changes, by the way, in terms of our collection effort that I'm hoping to enhance our ability to collect. I certainly am not speaking against House Bill 133. It bothers me greatly to see the state of Alaska with one hand handing out a permanent fund check to an individual that isn't paying back money on another, especially money under a student loan program that is as generous as the one that Alaska offers. So I certainly do not disagree with the intent behind this bill. By the way, the individuals that are 30 days or more delinquent, we'd be talking about, for instance, for the current month, 3,300 students are 30 days or more delinquent. Now, those are not in default, and there are some difficulties in that some people that owe us $10, $9, $10 a month pay us every third month or so just before they go into the default status, and that's something that would have to be addressed. What I would like the committee to consider, and I'd like to urge you to consider, is exactly what Representative Pierce indicated that she did give some consideration to and decided that she would rather take this approach. And that is, I would like to see legislation, either this bill amended or other legislation, that would state that if an individual is in default, and by the way, that is defined in law as 120 days past due, so we're talking about 4 months past due, if a person hits 120 days past due, that then this, the Commission on Post-Secondary Education would be able to attach the permanent fund dividend, as does child enforcement. Now, I would expect to be on the hierarchical order below child support, of course, but I would like to see that happen, and for the reason that Representative Pierce outlined. We do a computer match now. We do a computer run against permanent fund, and it helps us in two ways. Number one, it helps us find addresses. People are willing to tell the permanent fund folks where they are when they're not willing to tell us for some strange reason. So we do find a lot of people that way. Secondly, we do attach what we can. Now, it takes a court order, as you probably understand, for us to get our hands on that permanent fund dividend, and then we can get up to half of it. Last year, we did have a match of 2,000 individuals that were in default on their student loans, in default now, 120 days, that got permanent fund dividends. We, not all of them, got those. Because of the 800 that we already had court orders on, we got half of, so we got there first, and it works out nicely for us. But if indeed we could get that other 1,200, that would mean $600,000 into the revolving fund for the student loan program, money that could be used for loans. The way this bill is written, the money stays in the permanent fund. Clearly, you're just not eligible and it sits there. It does not enhance the fund, the corpus of the student loan fund at all. We feel that that's money that an individual has made an obligation to pay the state of Alaska, and we would like to be able to garnish, if you will, or to attach that money if the person is in default under the terms of their contract. And that would, I think that would enhance our collections greatly, would help the default as well. 30 days may be a little too punitive. We may have to do something, if you were going to take this approach, to 60 or 90 or something, because of those people that are just late in paying. But we would really encourage you to consider a bill or an amendment which would allow us to have the same access to the permanent fund dividend that child support does in SSA, in an order that would place us behind them in being able to attach it. And if you have any questions,
I'd
be happy
to
try to respond.
Overwhelmed. I guess I'll ask one quick question. Representative Pierce mentioned that she wasn't convinced it was appropriate for the Post-Secondary Education Commission to put on this other hat, this sort of quasi-judicial hat. To put on that other hat, would it require much additional staff, or is it something that, if as a policy matter we decide it was appropriate, is it something that you can absorb?
It wouldn't. Thank you. Madam Chair, it would require no staff at all. In fact, there would be a zero fiscal note in terms of what it would cost. All the fiscal note would not be zero because it would generate money for us. But we do the computer run now, and we already cooperate with the division that handles permanent fund distribution. So all it would simply mean would be a transfer of funds, and there would be absolutely no additional computer costs from our side, and certainly no staff effort at all.
Representative Pierce, do you have any other comments you'd like to make?
I guess I'd just like to reiterate that because of the fact that post-secondary is set up as a commission with people sitting on the commission who are appointed, I was uncomfortable with going that final step, and it is certainly something that bears discussion if the committee feels comfortable with it. And under further testimony, I haven't even had the Department of Law tell me whether or not we would have to change the statutes about the commission law to give them the authority, and I don't know the answer to that. I'm certainly willing to look at it. My feeling was that certainly a deterrent to receiving a permanent fund dividend for those people who are already delinquent would go a long way. I think when people got back a letter from Revenue saying, we're sorry, you can't have your dividend until you are caught up on your loan, that we would certainly get the attention of a lot of the people who are delinquent. So I'd like to see us do that at the very least, and then maybe go forward with looking at giving the commission the authority, but I think it needs a real close look.
Representative Hoffman, do you have a question?
I wonder if we can go over the
fiscal notes, someone could explain the version that we have here before us. I guess the two that I'm interested in are B and D.
Representative Hoffman, if you can, I can explain A very quickly. A is a zero fiscal note submitted from our agency, and that's because we already do the computer sort. B and D are from the Enforcement Division, would you like to?
Would it be appropriate if Representative Hoffman to ask Erwin Jones to join us at the table?
I was going to say that.
I believe so.
Mr. Jones, do you have a copy of what we're looking at?
Yes. Bear with me for just a moment. I don't have mine labeled, so let me
see.
Okay. Would you like me to just run through those fiscal notes? Thank you.
Would you please? That would be very helpful.
The document identified as B is a fiscal note prepared by myself for the Division of Administrative Services, and is an estimate of the cost to the division in terms of data processing cost, primarily a one-time cost for programming, represents 1 month of additional time for an analyst programmer to stay on board, who's now a seasonal position, a new position involved, to write the programs necessary to do this. Again, I'm just dealing with Representative Pierce's bill and talking about doing a match between the Department of Revenue and the Department, Post-Secondary Education Commission's identification of those students who on each day of the filing period are 30 days or more late in making their payments. Additional to that will be the requirement by the department to data capture the application date, something that is not now done and not now required by the program. I've estimated 540,000 applications. We're going to have to look at the age group that we're talking about, but I mean, as a practical matter, I suppose we're probably talking about 18-year-olds and up or 17-year-olds and up. Most of them would probably fall between 17 and 25 or something. That's something we'd work out with education. But not knowing that, I just assumed that we're going to be reviewing all 540,000 applications. Okay. Again, we're just talking about the data capture. The other two items, one is data processing chargeback, and I plugged that in at $5,000 because under the current system, the Department of Administration has established a chargeback system that charges agencies for data processing use above and beyond a base, and that base is the calendar year 1986 usage. To the extent that this causes additional use of their data processing resources, their mainframe computer, they will bill the Department of Revenue for that value under a very complicated system, and at this point it's really impossible for me to say it's going to be $4,000, $5,000, $6,000, or $15,000, but I think $5,000 is reasonable compared to what they're charging us now for the resources we currently use, which is approximately $500,000. The second item under contractual is to add a page to the permanent fund dividend booklet. We have approximately seven bills that in one way or the other affect the application on the permanent fund dividend application. We may, I've attributed the additional cost to each of these bills on the assumption that that's the only bill that will pass. If in fact 5, 6, 4, 3, or two of them do pass, we'll have to redo the fiscal notes because we'll have to then look at it as a known that there are two or three of these bills, and we'll recalculate that. Whether it results in that cost or not, we won't know until towards the end of the session. The other attachment was D, and that's the Department of Revenue Enforcement Division. I wish Tom was still here. He could explain this for himself.
If I could just add, Madam Chairman, the second fiscal note from enforcement has not yet been received by our office, so this is the first time I've seen it.
I might say it's the first time I've seen it.
I think we might all need to take a little while to mull this one over and give it some analysis, but...
If I could just make a comment from very briefly having looked at it, I think the appeals process is going to be rather short because post-secondary has a very clear distinction of who is indeed in default and who is indeed delinquent, and it goes by the number of days you are late, and they send you a notice, and it's not going to be a difficult process to say you are indeed delinquent on your loan or you are indeed in default on your loan. I don't think it's going to be all that hard to say we're right, you're delinquent.
Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. You list the funding as other, and I wonder, is that proceeds from the permanent fund dividend checks themselves, or is that revenue source from?
Madam Chair, Representative Hoffman, one of the assumptions is that, in my fiscal note, is that any incremental cost in administering this provision would be the same source of funding as the general administration of the dividend program. Currently, that is the dividend fund.
Okay, any questions at this point in time?
I would just assume that there should be a figure on the revenue line, too, in that case. Because you're going to be keeping some money in the fund that is not being paid out in dividends.
Madam Chair, I would agree with that.
Okay, unless there are any other questions, I think we will take this one under advisement and I'll have a chance to take a look at the fiscal note a little bit and move on to other testimony that people wish to give on some of the other bills before us. Thank you very much, Representative Pierce.
Sure, thank you.
Mary Halloran on HJR 1 and HJR 10.
Having a couple of sponsors, sir, I didn't realize that you're considering a vastly different committee substitute in these circumstances. I won't need to testify on HR 1. And
okay.
I'll wait on 10 the
okay.
Committee's budget.
All right. Okay, then going on to HJR 1, Representative Ellis, would you like to join us?
Sure.
It has been about 10 days or so, maybe even 2 weeks, since we looked at this one, and I wonder if, just to get us going in terms of a discussion, you would maybe make just a few introductory remarks about HJR 1.
Certainly. Thank you, Madam Chairman. I appreciate the opportunity to be with you again. I would just direct members' attention to Section 2, Part B. There's just one real operative sentence in this legislation, and it's that the legislature may not change distribution of income from the permanent fund except by law referred to a vote at a regular or special election. The law may not take effect unless approved by the majority of those voting in that election. This simply, once again, I'll repeat that this legislation, if it were to pass and to pass muster with the public in the next election, would have no impact on our ability this session or in any future session to expend the funds currently or in the future in the earnings reserve account. The legislature would be hindered in no way in coming up with any kind of plan to modify the dividend or inflation proofing, which many people see as a major problem coming in the years ahead. We would just pass such a law in session and refer it to a vote of the people, and it would take effect at a special election if we needed to move quickly or at the next regular election. So this is really just letting the people of Alaska have a say in the distribution of the permanent fund they created. I think all of you have been provided with, many of you were there when Governor Hammond testified at that last committee hearing, and those remarks have been supplied for those who were not in attendance. I just say to conclude that a number of other legislators have introduced legislation regarding the permanent fund. The chairman noted, referenced that at the beginning of this session, a number of those items that are now coming before the House of Representatives, several that were just introduced today, have sort of a public comment portion to them, either advisory votes or public testimony through a commission system that Representative Boucher is proposing. And so I'm gratified that people are catching on to the idea that the vast majority of Alaskans would like to have a say in the disposition of the earnings of the fund. And so I don't see anything contrary with this legislation and proposals that are being put forward by the administration, by other legislators, to deal with our revenue shortfalls. I have my opinions about those, but I do know that the people of Alaska do want to have a say in the distribution of fund earnings, and that's what this legislation would provide.
Are there any committee questions? Representative Martin?
Are we on the end?
We are, yes, we have a an observer in Petersburg, so if you would use that, that would be fine. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. To the sponsor, have you received an AG's opinion yet on the rights or limits of rights that legislators may give the voters in relationship to the people being able to express themselves as to how appropriations will be spent? This question has come up in past legislatures, and twice now the people have been overruled, and as Governor Hammond said himself, when we allow the people to vote online for the capital move, his Attorney General brought forth the philosophy that land equals money, and therefore, even though the people did approve the selling of land for the capital move, that since it's in the field with the legislators' rights of appropriation, therefore the ballot question was mute, and no one challenged it yet, but it did bring out the major question: can we even delegate our authority for the people to vote on appropriations? Also, I'll remind you, and the AGs had that opinion, where the people were even denied the rights to vote on taxation, because they said that was only the rights of the legislators, and we cannot delegate that right to the people, even though revenues, taxation is revenues and not appropriations. The AG said that revenues are future appropriations. Somehow, everybody mixed that up. But here we're doing the same thing, but it's even clearer that we're telling the people that they will have the rights to appropriations, whether through dividend debts, dividend checks, or inflation proofing or whatever, is still us delegating. So in short, do you have an AG's opinion on the constitutionality of this?
Thank you, Representative Martin. I am familiar with AG's opinions that have made the distinction between advisory votes and appropriations. Just my reading of the Constitution speaks very specifically to taxation and the right to tax, and that being reserved to the legislature and not being able to be given to anyone else, either the executive or the public. But in terms of, I don't understand your argument about appropriations.
Okay. You're exactly right, Madam Chairman. Depending on the department, whether it be a of Article 2, and there is where our problem is. If we pass out any of these bills, whether people want part of the checkoff list to be for the Mickey Mouse Club or Donald Duck Club, do we have the right to let them do that? Yours is even more specific, telling people that through the voting process, they will demand their rights to speak on how permanent funds revenues are spent. And I think that we have a real bad constitutional question here. If you lock those interest monies up by a constitutional question and the people vote on it, then what about the future legislatures? One legislative body cannot bind the next legislative body on any appropriations. And so we're getting into that. Can the public tell the legislators you will never touch these revenues?
Representative Donnelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I first of all, I want to apologize. I wasn't at the meeting that this was discussed before. But was there any consideration given to the aspect of placing the portion of the dividend that deals with the percentage that goes towards the dividends, it's in statute now, into this legislation, so that would be part of the Constitution?
and thus you would get around the any resemblance of the problem Representative Martin raised by simply if it wished to be changed, then people could place it on the ballot for approval as an amendment to the Constitution.
There was no discussion that I remember at the last committee hearing on that point.
I guess just to clarify, the proposed CS, which is dated 221 or 3A, doesn't actually lock into the Constitution a particular distribution fund or formula. It simply says that when the legislature changes it, it has to get ratified by the people. So, Representative Martin, your concern about a legislature binding a future legislature, I think, has been accommodated by this new CS, because any new legislature would be perfectly free to put in a new distribution formula annually if it chose to. It would simply not go into effect until, if and until, the people in a general election would say yes. So, in a sense, I think it avoids that constitutional problem. I don't know whether it fully avoids the other constitutional point you have raised, and that is this concern about whether the people of the state have a right to appropriation or tax issues. I haven't seen, I don't remember the AG's opinions to which you refer, and I'd love to get a copy. Do you have copies of those by any chance?
The back of the board, I've been keeping time. Yeah. Madam Chairman, for me, I've been keeping things on that for a long time, on those opinion, but no, rather than someone said, this is a Martin's biased opinion, I'm asking to go to the AG and ask them to give an opinion on this. Now, the people do have a referendum rights on appropriations, and if something passes through the legislature that the people do not like on appropriation, that is the reason you have a referendum. Within a certain period of time, they can get ballots out and stop that appropriations. That's what's the difference between a referendum right and the initiative rights.
I just realized I was going down the path of some erroneous thinking here. First of all, this is an amendment to the Constitution.
Yes.
So if we're amending the Constitution, the specific overrides the general. Mm-hmm. So this would, it would be no problem constitutionally with this, because by changing this, adding this portion to the Constitution, then we're saying it's okay under the Constitution.
Madam Chairman, that's exactly the point. Do we have the right to do so? If so, then I say that another section of the Constitution must be changed, and it has to do with, I'm pretty sure it's Section 2, Legislative Powers of Appropriations. And I'm only asking now, let's get an Attorney General's opinion. Doesn't think about that's why they're there.
Representative Donnelly, you have a follow-up?
Yeah, I it just seems very clear to me that there's no potential constitutional problem here, because it's a specific provision that's an amendment to the Constitution that provides for that. And by doing so, you don't present any constitutional problem. It's a very basic rule that any specific provision overrides any general provision. So by adopting this, it's the whole issue's moot.
Anyone else have any questions for Representative Ellis or any comments?
Madam Chairman, can we get an AG's opinion?
I'm not sure that we can get one. I suppose we can ask. I don't know. Representative Ellis, I assume you have not spoken with anyone in the AG's office, but you probably have with someone in the legal services section.
I have spoken with many, many people, and as Representative Martin and I discussed last time, the legal counsel in legislative affairs was very clear on this point, and there is no problem in their opinion, or with any of the other people in the administration that I've consulted. The Judiciary Committee is the next committee of referral, and I, you know, if I were convinced that there were any, or even unsure about any kind of constitutional problem here, I would request an AG's opinion. And if the judiciary, I mean, there are better minds than mine on the Judiciary Committee in terms of these kinds of questions, and if it's a question at that point, I think that would be appropriate.
Other discussion? Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman, I have different opinions too, especially on the taxation, voters' approval of taxation. Legal Service says we are absolutely right on this constitutional. AG says, no, you're absolutely wrong, and it's no use in wasting time on the legislation. So, I would beg to differ with the judiciary's mentality or intelligence compared to this, this group, too. I think I have a little more intelligence than some of them. That's a biased opinion.
Okay. Getting back to HJR 1. Other comments? Representative Hoffman.
Yes, Madam Chairman, I guess I would support Representative Martin's request for an AG's opinion, but we have several other pieces of legislation before us, and it's noted in the resolution that any changes in the distribution after January 1, 1987 would have to be approved by the voters. So if that is that would encompass all the legislation that we're dealing with that would affect the distribution of income from the permanent fund. So I guess we should discuss that aspect of it, and if we're given serious consideration to this, maybe change that to January 1, 1988, 89, or 90. 91 seems to be a very popular year. I guess I still feel that my personal opinions are that we as elected officials have been chosen by the people to make decisions on our constituents' behalf. If we make the wrong ones, then it's their prerogative to change us. And I guess I don't support the resolution because of that.
Representative Donlin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the Chair, I have a question on the prime sponsor. What was the thinking of the January 1, 1987 date? Is there a particular reason for that date, or do you think it might be more appropriate to shoot for January 1, 1989?
Well, the date was put into the legislation to give a time certain from which this would be effective, and it was just the beginning of this year, and so would encompass decisions made during this legislative session, because I had a recognition early on that the earnings reserve account of the permanent fund, inflation proofing, and the dividend, and ultimately the principal of the permanent fund, were under consideration this session, and so I chose to give coverage to decisions made by this legislature.
I just wonder if the prime sponsor would have any objection to the committee maybe changing that date to 89. The only difficulty I see arising with 87 is that identified by Representative Hoffman, and that won't be up for ratification by the voters until the 88 election. So that kind of a leapfrog problem there, where the legislature adopted for the next 2 years might become null and void by ratification of this amendment in the 88 election, thus requiring them to come back in the next general election and seek ratification. And I don't know, maybe I'm getting off on a tangent here. But
no, you're absolutely right. You know, that's up to the committee. I don't know, we've had some discussion about binding future legislatures. We're, of course, not doing that, but if you wanted to exempt this legislature from coverage of the amendment, if that's the committee's feeling, I won't object strongly to that, because the principle here is what I'm defending. And the date that everything kicks in is your prerogative. I would prefer the 1987 date, but reality may come to play here, and I'll leave that to the committee's decision.
Representative Menard?
Just following up on this date, reality may be as soon as Friday, I understand.
That's right.
As things are coming around. So it does put us in an interesting position, whether we support this date or another date, because of the depending on how the vote goes on Friday. I haven't totally made my mind up as of yet. I guess I'll drop it at that.
Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman, if it's the sponsor's intent to proceed with that date, and I can understand, man, lock that thing in as soon as you can, because this legislature may have a field day on how to use that money before the election comes out, then I believe we need another fiscal note from the Division of Election, because on my bill, they very handsomely treated it. You know, if you have another ballot question, it's going to cost so many thousand, and I think they put 30,000 on there just for the ballot question of the rights to vote on taxation. This one here, 2.2, very generous, especially if we have a special election to implement this for 87, it would be at least 150,000 at minimum. I think most elections cost us about 2 million.
Representative Martin, I think that is based on the assumption it would just be part of the next general election. And so, I mean, it's
2.2 even at that is. I don't know why his ballot question would be so much cheaper than mine.
Representative Martin, it may have something to do with the explanation necessary you know, provide a rationale.
we need a lot more than mine.
Okay, any other comments, suggestions, questions? Representative Donnelly, do you have something you want to say?
Madam Chair, I was just prepared to make a motion or move. I didn't want to cut off Representative Lyman. Looks like he had further comment.
Okay.
Well, I, as I stated before, I guess I would rather have Representative Martin's question answered before I take action on this, and I have some concerns, I guess, on the date. We're talking about action that may happen on Friday, and using that as an example, I guess, say we take that action, the body doesn't take action on this, the date stays the same, the governor spends the funds, the voters sometime down the future don't approve of that expenditure. Where are we?
No, that's not true, Representative Hoffman. This Friday, the expected vote is to, this Friday we may be voting on House Bill 89 again, coming back from the Senate. That's regarding the budget reserve account.
Right.
In the near future, we may be expected to vote on spending funds from the earnings reserve account. As I'll just say it again, this legislation has nothing to do with the earnings reserve account. That decision can be made by this legislature, and there is no impact. We have the current statutory authority to spend every dime in the earnings reserve account. There's no relationship between that action and this legislation. Now, if we were to vote this Friday on capping the dividend, or on doing away with inflation proofing, or any other thing that's been proposed this session that deal with those that changes the way we distribute permanent fund earnings, then that action would have to be ratified by a vote of the people at a special election or the next general election. Please don't get confused. This has nothing to do with the earnings reserve account. But in regard to what Representative Menard, his comment a moment ago, all of these things, of course, are connected. If we spend the earnings reserve account, the $550 million that's expected to be there after we cash out one-third of our stock portfolio, I think we're all intelligent enough to realize that that increases pressure. Since the institutional dynamic here, I've quickly learned, is to spend everything we have as quickly as we possibly can. Once our cash reserves are gone, of course the pressure on inflation proofing and dividends and ultimately the principal increases. That's the only connection.
Representative Martin.
Yes, I need to clarify on myself. I've only voted, Madam Chairman, for one budget in the past 8 years. And I'm glad to see the gentleman be so conservative when the next budget comes out.
Representative Donovan.
Madam Chair, I'd move to pass CS for House Joint Resolution Number 1, State Affairs, with individual recommendations.
I'd like to object, Madam Chairman.
Okay, objection has been noted. Is there additional discussion? All those in favor of moving this resolution out with individual recommendations, please say aye.
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 All those opposed, please say no.
Opposed.
Opposed.
Okay. Two opposed, four for moving it out, and so CS for HJR 1 does move out of State Fair System.
Thank you very much.
Our next resolution is HJR 10, and I would be happy to hear from whoever wishes to testify. Other than Mary Halloran, is there anyone else who does wish to testify on HJR 10? Mary Halloran.
All good, man.
If, first of all, my apologies to the committee for not, thank you, Connie. My apologies to the committee for not attending the earlier hearings on HJR 1 and HJR 10. And in some senses, my testimony today may be a little bit repetitive that offered by other members of the administration earlier on HJR 1 in particular, when you had the original bill before you. And it still applies to the version of HJR 10 in front of you. Our concern with this piece of legislation is that although we can both understand and sympathize with the intent that underlies HJR 10, that is to provide an ongoing fund for education in Alaska, we feel that the method that's been chosen by this resolution will in fact adversely affect the ability of the state to carry out that intent. What HJR 10 does is that, it, number one, it locks the earnings of the permanent fund into a 50% distribution for dividends, and then it says, number two, that it basically says there is no more inflation proofing, and that the balance of the monies will then go to public education in Alaska. As the Permanent Fund Corporation has pointed out to you, I believe in material presented to the committee before, in that large packet of to the chair dated February 23rd, that they have done a run, and it's run number 17 in the packet, of what this actually does, in fact, to the Permanent Fund principal and earnings. I'm not sure if the committee has that. I'll be glad to revise or leave that for you again. It's
actually, I think we have it attached to one of these sheets. Let's see. Now, it is in your general file on permanent fund income distribution. A real thick one that you've got, I think. You've got it in this one, too?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. You've probably got several copies of it. Okay.
Okay, basically what it does, and without getting into the numbers and the calculations behind them, I think basically what it does is that this approach, by eliminating inflation proofing, actually decreases the principal of the fund over the years and decreases the ability of the fund, therefore, to generate income and to support public services such as education. The better procedure from a policy perspective, if your real concern in the long term is to provide adequate funding for education in the future, is in fact to protect inflation proofing, which in turn protects the principal of the fund, and to look with a very careful eye towards any sort of mandatory level of requirement for dividends. That's the kind of the bottom line there. The other thing that, going away from the numbers, I'd like to pass out to the committee the other side of the coin. I think what the administration would also like everyone to keep very much in mind as we begin all these debates and this discussion about the use of the permanent fund earnings is that over the long run, Alaska has only two sources of revenue for all its public services. One is the one that we're currently relying on, i.e. oil, and the other is the permanent fund earnings. And for those members of the committee who are new to the legislature, I know for people like Terry, this is very repetitive.
It's always new.
It's always new. But as the chart as the chart will show you, this is the high year in terms of Prudhoe Bay production. This is the last of the volume of oil. It's not only that we have the variable price to be concerned about, but we also have the variable volume. There is nothing in Alaska's future at the moment that's going to replace the volume of Prudhoe Bay production. It begins a very dramatic downward curve. Someone asked me before, what about ANWR? The timeline for production out of ANWR, at its most optimistic, is 14 years from now. And so we have a major problem coming up. A major problem is, I think, displayed fairly graphically on the next page, where you get a sense of where the state's revenues are coming from in the future. And this is without talking about where you allocate these revenues to, but just where they're coming from. The black part of the chart is that part of the revenues which come from oil generation, for the unrestricted general revenues as we now know them. The white part of the graph is permanent fund earnings. I think what is important for everyone to begin to realize is that it's not very far in the future when permanent fund earnings overtake completely the oil revenues that are coming into the state. And so we're going to be relying, the crossover point in terms of nominal dollars is based on the January forecast, 1998. That's a mere 10 years away from now. And so we're very concerned as an administration that the public begin to understand, as well as the members of the administration and in the legislature, that when we're talking about use of the permanent fund earnings, we're talking about 10 years from now, that's the majority of the revenues coming into the state, not this little additional incremental amount that we all enjoy at the moment. The numbers in back of that are from the January revenue forecast. They're in nominal dollars. And again, I don't think the numbers themselves are so important as the recognition of the bottom line, which is that crossover point between revenues sources comes very, very quickly. And so that's why we're concerned about anything that decreases the ability of the legislature to respond to the fiscal situation that the state's going to be facing over the next 10 years. And resolution HDR 10 that's in front of you, in fact, heavily impacts, in fact, it almost restricts totally, your ability to deal with the future fiscal situation in a flexible manner to meet whatever the needs of the future may be, whether it's schools, public safety, health care, you name the gamut, capital construction. I mean, there are always things that are out there that aren't just schools. So I guess the only other thing, just for informational purposes, in case it hasn't been presented to the committee before, this run shows, this is the permanent fund's projection of earnings based on what happens after the stock sale of last, that was announced a week ago. I think here, what's important to note, under the income column to the right, on the income column to the right, I see Representative Hanley and Pierce might, and Ellis might appreciate this. That between the current mechanism for inflation proofing and distributing dividends to the state's population, we began to eat away at the remaining portion of the permanent fund earnings very, very quickly. Within, and this is without looking at the fact that we may have to draw on those earnings this fiscal year and next fiscal year just to balance the budget. The current mechanisms for inflation proofing and dividends eat away at the remaining portion of the earnings of the permanent fund, such that as of 1994, we have no other money to spend. We have nothing else. We have a zero from there on out. So I think it's important for people to begin to realize that. We will be coming back to the committee, if the chair wishes, with some detailed information on that at a later date, but we just wanted to lay, I just wanted for today's purposes to begin to lay some of this information on the table, to begin to raise some of the concerns that we see about this whole area, and to help, and I appreciate the chair's graciousness in letting us do so.
We appreciate the information because it helps us make better decisions. Representative Martin.
Thank you. Madam Chairman, I don't know, Ms. Holloman, if Commissioner Malone has had a chance to talk with you, but I did talk to him the other day about all these bills in front of us, and he said he is concerned and that he would talk to the Attorney General and see what is involved as far as legislative prerogative and how we can put some of these bills into the Constitution before the public with the education funding and a university dedication and so on. I was wondering, Ms. Holloman, has he had a chance to talk to you about it? Has anyone from his department talked to the AG yet?
Not that I'm aware of, but I'll check.
Madam Chairman, if I may continue. One of the other major points with the information your office gave us before, and I think it was about 10 different scenarios we have here, and I think a lot of people fail to see under the different scenarios how quick that we are going to get into an indebtedness with inflation proofing. Now, this one here starts at 1994 fiscal year at 107 deficit, but the other one that we were using at current plan showed 39 in about 91, maybe even later.
Right. This is the adjustment that was made because of the corporation's decision to sell the stock. So this now becomes, quote, the reality. Yeah.
Okay. I noticed that the date was January 31. You all had a little preconception that thing was going to come in.
This was run by the Permanent Fund Corporation, so we just I'm just distributing their data for you.
Okay.
Last
question I had, Madam Chair, if I may, to the witness, is that you know you gave beautiful testimony as to why we should hold off on the last joint resolution we passed. Did the administration have any? I wasn't here at all the meetings, and I apologize. Like today, I had to extend it. Did you all give an opinion on the one we just passed, Mr. Ellison's bill?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. We helped, apparently, different members of the administration have worked with Representative Ellis on the difference between the original version and the committee substitute. With the original version, I would have voiced many of the same concerns that I'm now raising with HDR 10, that it locked us into some inflexible ways of doing business right at the moment when it appears we need the most fiscal flexibility.
For the record, there was strenuous objection from the administration to the original version of HJR 1, but the committee substitute version, while they may not be enthusiastic about it, they are not objecting to it.
Do you still agree with that? I think that's accurate.
Yeah. Yes,
even though it locks your hands, too, I mean, as he's saying, it's going to lock the legislature. I don't know where the administration is going to get more flexibility than we have. If it locks our hands, you mean you got an opening in there someplace?
Not that I'm aware of.
Any more discussion or questions for Ms. Halloran on HJR 10 or on any of the information presented? I guess I'd have a hypothetical, which I do not expect you to be able to answer at this point in time, but as you will be back before the committee, I'm sure, on this and on related issues, I'd just like you to think about. Representative Oral Freeman had a proposal of 40-40-20. Okay. 40% of the income to go for dividends, 40% to go for, was it inflation proofing or the 20% for inflation?
20 for inflation.
20 for inflation and the other 40 for general operating expenses of government. And I've heard some discussion lately about maybe we ought to rethink that proposal, maybe either 40-40-20 or one-third, to give some predictability as to how much will be available for general operating expenses of government, to maybe reduce slightly the amount available for dividends so that you're not pushing that 1,000 per capita mark, which makes a lot of people nervous, and still doing a pretty good job of inflation proofing, although admittedly not as good as the current formula. And I guess I'd just be interested in knowing if the administration is giving any thought to something along those lines, and if so, when you're ready to talk about it, what you would suggest.
I think from our perspective, the fundamental policy that this administration is going to try to follow, difficult as it may be, is to decide the policy and the programs first and the revenue sources to follow. We don't want to get into the situation where the amount of revenue available drives the policy and the program decisions. What we want to do instead, and it will take, it obviously is one of those things that takes torturous amounts of time, is to decide what needs, what basic services do Alaskans not only want, but basically have to have, and then how much is it going to cost to deliver those effectively and efficiently, and then what's the revenue available to do that, and then look at the gap and decide how to fill that gap, whether it's through permanent fund earnings, additional tax measures, or whatever. So I think that would be the fundamental premise from which we'll be trying to operate, from a philosophical approach. That aside, we're having discussions with the governor this week over what his basic policies are going to be regarding the use of the permanent fund earnings. I think it's already clear from the bill that's been introduced in both the House and the Senate that he does believe that the earnings are in fact there to be used for state operations when it's necessary, and we think it's necessary to meet the 87 deficit and to balance the 87-88 budget. And there are other aspects that we will be wanting to talk to you about later.
Well, just to follow up on that, I think your graph demonstrates very graphically the second one particularly, that shows the relationship between permanent fund earnings and other unrestricted revenues, what an important role in the future the earnings will play in supporting government. And I guess it is along those lines that I am giving more thought to, and although I have not thought it through, I guess I would like whatever analysis the administration is willing to share with us on having some sort of more predictable formula with regard to dividend program, inflation proofing, and earnings being used for the general fund. Okay, any other questions for Mary Halloran? Thank you very much for joining us. Is there any other testimony on HJR 10? Any other discussion by committee members of HJR 10? Wild enthusiasm, I can see.
If we pass this last one, nothing else matters. It'd be contradictory.
Maybe and maybe not. I don't know. I assume that it is the wish of the committee to leave HJR 10 in committee for the time being. Anyway, okay, then the other issue which we have not taken up today, HB 128, the sponsor had a conflict and asked that we consider that at a different time. HB 134, Representative Pierce, I believe that's your bill. Would you join us at the table again, please? Would you be willing to give us an overview of HB 134?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Once again, for the record, I am Representative Drew Pierce. I'd like now to speak about another bill, House Bill 134, an act permitting payment of certain permanent fund dividends into the principal of the permanent fund. This legislation would allow an individual who is eligible to receive a permanent fund dividend to elect, if he or she so desired, to direct that the payment of the dividend be made directly into the corpus of the fund without the warrant ever being cut, sent to the recipient, and that person having to then in turn send it back. Last year, I introduced House Bill 462, which was similar to this bill. I have been encouraged to reintroduce this legislation by individuals in Anchorage who had asked me to introduce it in the first place. And the feeling that I most often get from these people is that although they do not necessarily agree with the dividend program philosophically, they also don't want to see the money left in the earnings for us to spend any way we see fit. They'd like to see it go into the corpus of the fund. And so I thought, since we seem to be into checking off places for permanent fund dividends to go, it seemed to me that it would be much easier for a person to be able to apply for their dividend, do a checkoff that said it goes to the corpus, and save the bookkeeping and the time and trouble that it takes to send a check to the person and have them turn around and send that check back to the permanent fund. I appreciate the opportunity to address you. I'll be happy to answer any questions. It's really very simple. And the, I believe that the two fiscal notes reflect, as have all the others, the fact that there are seven different bills that have checkoffs, and each of these fiscal notes are done assuming that that was the only checkoff that, that went into law.
Are there any questions? Representative Halpin?
Historically, how many people have been sending their checks back to the corpus of the permanent fund on an annual basis?
I don't know the answer to that.
Does anyone from the Department of Revenue know the answer to that question?
Madam Chair, in preparing the fiscal notes, we consulted the Permanent Fund Corporation. They do receive contributions to the permanent fund as miscellaneous income, and according to Mr. Jim Kelly, one person has done that on four different occasions.
Okay. Only one person?
Yes.
It has not been, I think that there are, there's no way to tell how many people there are out there, and that's why I reintroduced it, seeing that there were a lot of other bills being put in that would have checkoffs for different purposes for your dividend, thinking that it was another option that people could take if, like I said, they didn't want to leave the funds in the earnings account or in the income stream for us to spend, but would rather see the money go directly to the corpus. It's impossible, really, for us to say how many people don't apply for dividends because philosophically we don't believe in them.
Representative Menard?
Madam Chair, for the record, I was just going to say, the only time I sent the checks back was when I got three checks in the same year. So.
We're proud of for you. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It sounds to me like the option is already there. You just send it back, or I understand the book saving, the bookkeeping saving, but I don't know. I guess I'm not convinced that it's necessary legislation. And what happens to that fickle individual who sends it back and then decides that he wants it again? I mean, this is not unrealistic.
Well, I think that the fickle individual who does that has lost his or her permanent fund check for that year. I don't think fickleness is a defense in court. But I agree that it is not a necessary thing, but I do see it as like I say, I was asked to introduce it, and I have done so for the second time. I've had a lot of people say that they thought it was a good idea, and it would indeed cut down on the process that it takes to go through, and I think that we would see more people putting their checks into the corpus if they indeed could do it. Obviously, it's not something that the state is going to continue to roll or not on whether or not we pass this bill, and I've never claimed that it was.
Representative Martin.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. I haven't applied for my dividend yet this year, although I have got a application saying that I can file late. As Representative Pierce mentioned that some of us, Governor Hammond said it's stupid, some of them have principles, though. If you're against it, as I've been from the very beginning, then you look for different options of using it. Right now, I know it's back in the general funds. If it can go back into the principal, I still don't want to worry about filling out all the paperwork just to put me in there. But I might do that, considering all the other options that are coming down the line, too. One more like this for people that believe in the principal, and if that being better than taxation, in my mind, I wouldn't mind putting it back in the principal, and perhaps at the same time, that may preclude me from using that as a tax credit. I don't know how that works, how the governor's office would feel about it. But I think it's another logical option that other people have. You ask how many people haven't received a check. I guess the best thing that we can go by is the census that was certified from 1985 and now in the blue book of 539,600. Well, the department said that we had just above 539,000 applied for application. So maybe there's 600 people that don't believe in it principle-wise that did not file applications.
Mm-hmm. Representative Davidson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems the easiest way, really, to accomplish this is if we're going to send applications out, just simply have on the application, if you do not want this dividend, please do not fill this out.
Mm-hmm. Representative Pierce.
Representative Davidson, I agree that if people don't want their dividends, obviously no one is making them apply. This, however, would go a step further and put their dividend into the corpus of the fund, and that is not what happens now with the dollars And that's the difference. These dollars would actually go into the corpus if you so desired.
I see. Thank you.
Any other committee questions or comments? Do you have anything to add, Department of Revenue representatives?
No.
Okay. Any other testimonies? It does come to mind, as we look at down this list of the various checkout programs, that what's coming out of this discussion, for me anyway, is that it might make sense to have one bill, one comprehensive bill that provides for all the different checkoff programs with one fiscal note. And, you know, maybe after the committee has an opportunity to give a little more thought to some of these other proposals, we might want to do a State Affairs Committee bill that rolls these all together instead of having these individual ones flying around. I don't know. Representative Hoffman?
While we're considering all these, I think that we should keep in mind that we don't want to make the process too complicated for the people. I know that many good intentions to streamline things and get more information and more options to people sometimes complicate them, and I guess the example that I would use would be the federal government's W-4 form, and I would, warn people that when we're talking about all these options, there's the possibility of complicating the application process to the people.
Any other comments? Representative Martin.
Madam Chairman, I kind of agree with you that we do have a lot of requests already, and there's two new ones over in the Senate. One, your check off for your political preference for your political party, which is nice. It's rather selfishly serving. I'm going to put my candidacy District 13 in there. But we have many people coming. I can see it now. More nonprofit organizations, Boys Club, Boys, Girl Scouts, Campfire Girls,